is the tabletop game where the only thing you know is that you have to run. And you cannot stop until you remember who you are.
I'm Epistory Richard, former coordinator of London Indie RPG and founder of The Pipeline.
I'm Robert Carnell, and we need to get out of here fast.
So, Rob, why are we talking about Syron?
Firstly, it's a rip-roarer of a game. It's exciting, thrilling. It's about action, adventure, amnesiac superheroes, and the thrill of the chase, or the danger of the chase. And from a metagame perspective, I think we're talking about it because it is explicitly an introductory game, one aimed at teenagers, about getting them into gaming, but also introducing a slightly different experience from what you might associate with the conventional tropes of role-playing about combat, danger, and effectively dominating or overcoming the opposition.
So the lead designer is Meg Baker, who also wrote 1001 Nights, which is a game which seems to be purpose-built to find a use for all those gorgeous gem dice that you find no other use for over the years. And she also more recently wrote, or she compiled, Nature's Year. I think that was...
Yeah, so that was on Kickstarter, right?
Yeah.
So I think the last Meg Baker thing I read was a nano game about Valiant Girls, which was another kind of outreach project, this time specifically to teenage girls, about overcoming issues in their the society they live in.
So it's unusually for us, it's a GM'd game as well, though...
I actually think that since this game is deliberately meant to be facilitated, the interesting thing is that I don't think it needs a GM to drive the narrative. Now, I think that's something we're probably going to have to discuss. What is traditionally called the GM role is really about the colour and the detail of the world, and providing the colour over the mechanics to explain it, because every game is going to be custom to the group. And secondly, because the game is about running and escaping, you need someone who can provide that world that they're interacting with. So it's not a closed group game, it's not like a closed room game where the characters only ever need to interact with the characters. And I think a lot of games that are effectively open world struggle if players also have to be their characters and also provide the colour of the world.
So, and this is something that we specifically mentioned when we talked about Vast and Star.
Yes.
And it was a bit of a bone of contention where I said that while our characters are supposed to be on the run, they're supposed to be escape convicts, they're supposed to be that kind of Blake Seven or Far Escape kind of vibe going on, but there is nothing within the game that brings in that external force. But actually here, in Syron, that external force is very, very clear and a big driver for the impetus of the game.
Yeah. So the central conceit of the game is that the players will be taking the roles of characters who start the game in some form of incarceration, suffering from either permanent or temporary amnesia that is going to be replaced by truths about their characters in the course of the game. So at least in the first scene of the game, an opportunity to escape arises. The first scene also gives the first hints of the people called the Chasers, who are going to track down the characters over the course of the game. And from that first scene, the characters are then on the run from the Chasers. And it uses quite a simple mechanic. I personally use post-it notes. But each location where the scene is, starting with the escape scene, is written down and put on the table, and a token is used to indicate where the escaping characters are, and a token indicates where the chasers are. When they encounter situations where success is uncertain, then we go to a dice mechanism.
You build the pool by placing things at risk.
Yes.
So you start off with a definite pool of four, and then by placing additional things at risk, you then get to add further dice, but which is then limited by how injured you are.
You roll dice, you get results, But the thing that's really powerful with the mechanic is that the player decides how to assign their results, good or bad. So there is essentially a playmat used with different slots for dice, and the meaning of those slots will change according to the circumstances of the scene. So the player is essentially in control of the outcome. They essentially decide what they value in the result and where they're prepared to take a hit.
So the game talks about it as you roll dice whenever there is a significant action. And then there are three basic categories for any type of significant action, like goal, revealing a memory in the chasers, and then you can risk additional things if you're using your side powers or if you're putting yourself at risk of harm.
Depending on how the dice work, there are some really powerful decisions that the player can make for their character. And I would say a really good example is, do I hurt others or do I hurt myself? Which is one of the outcomes of the psi powers.
Mm. If you want to improve your odds of achieving your goal the most, then you put the most things at risk, so you're rolling the most dice. Mm. But the problem is with that is that you then have to assign dice to the things that you put at risk. You can achieve your goal, but you're causing worse and worse consequences either to yourself or to others or to both as a result of your determination in order to achieve it.
The end game occurs when one of the characters has recovered a predetermined number of memories that you assign at the start of the game, and the game then enters into an end game phase. Once again, you've done the historical detective thing.
Yeah, it has a really interesting and also heartening and kind of really indie history to it. So the root of it is a dice concept, which is called Other Kind Dice, which was posted by Vincent Baker in his blog. And that concept of this idea of rolling, placing things at risk and then allowing you to roll more dice, but then requiring you to allocate your dice out to those categories, to the things that you place at risk, was then taken by a couple of guys, Chris Moore and Michael Linger, who then had this idea of, oh, wouldn't it be great to use it for superpowered or superhero? And they created Cyron as an ashcan, which enjoyed a small circulation. And one of the people who, of course, saw it was Meg Baker, who absolutely loved it and saw great potential in it, took it around to libraries, to gaming groups, in order to encourage people to play it because she felt it was such a good introductory game, but wanted it to be published properly. And when she asked and they agreed that she could then take it forward and rewrite it completely, fix the problems that she found through her own playtesting, and then have it published so that a far wider kind of audience could enjoy it. And so it's got a really intertwined history, but one which is full of other people just springboarding off the inspiration of others. So the design's intent, as she describes, is very clearly one of, obviously, to tell the story of a chase story, of something like a fugitive or several different strands of the X-Men, but also to create a game which is one which is very accessible, very self-contained, and also very easy to follow along, which is good as introductory and good for first-time gamers.
When you're playing a game with Cyron, I think it really does kind of create this idea of claustrophobia and being on the run, the sense of mystery and confusion as to what's going on.
So one of the things that I was alluding to earlier and that I love about this central mechanic of Cyron is that it encourages the players to engage with it, and it doesn't encourage them in a kind of a bribery way to say, oh, if you roll these dice, you may get this particular resource or asset or whatever. I've seen this happen, is players start off and they originally see the play mat and they see about how there's a possibility of things going wrong, so they try to avoid having significant actions, they try to avoid rolling dice because they see that the chasers can only move. Technically this isn't true, but it looks like the chasers can only move when the dice are rolled, it looks like they can only take harm when the dice are rolled, but other people can get killed when the dice are rolled, so they avoid it. But then they quickly realize that because of the way the game is structured, because the game only ends when a certain number of memories are recovered, And the only way to recover those memories, to reveal those memories, is by rolling dice, is that it means that very quickly they realize, no, I should be taking significant actions. And so after the initial kind of like getting to know you, as they all start kind of getting within the skins of their characters, they become more adventurous. They look to take significant actions. They look to make harder choices about, okay, I can't use reveal as my dump stat to put my one in anymore. I've got to maybe put that in psi or take the harm or maybe not achieve my goal because I need to recover those memories. Otherwise, the game is never, ever going to end.
And I think there's some beautiful symmetry here because you can play safe, but you are still on the run. And I think all the players, even on their first run through, realize that yes, they can play safe and not have bad things happen, but their circumstances fundamentally don't change. They are still on the run. They have no effective way to fight back against the chasers. They are fugitives. They are the underdog. And the only way that they can change their circumstances is to discover who they really are.
And the neat thing about giving the players, giving the runners an advantage if they place additional things at risk, is that it means that they buy into the risk. It means that you are never there as a GM saying, you failed your role, you need to take two harm or take like 5 hit point damage or whatever, which they may feel as though something is being done for them. Is it
because it's far less confrontational.
Mm.
They are in power. It comes back. It's massively empowering. It's a game that's massively empowering.
They're making the choice to place this particular thing at risk, and then they normally will have a choice to say, okay, I'm putting my low die in that particular category, and so my psi powers do go wild and hurt people, or I do take harm myself.
And they're shaping the story and the consequences every step of the way. I think that's really powerful.
It's bringing in all the things that are relevant to the story. So as much as you can say, it is, you do get used to it after just a couple of throws, but when you're first reading through it, when I was first reading through it, I was like, I am taking a moment to try to get my head around this. This does feel a little bit clunky. I am rolling a lot of dice and then having to assign them out and then having to do the consequences does feel a little bit onerous. It doesn't feel like fast way, but then when you realize that this is not a game where you are expected to be rolling dice several times in a particular scene, is that this is a game in which you're expected to roll dice maybe once every few scenes. And so it's okay in that context. It's okay to have a slightly longer time to roll the dice and allocate the dice, and it becomes a lot quicker and a lot smoother. But it brings in all the things that are relevant to the game. It brings in the recovery of memories, it brings in the chases, and it brings in your side powers. And so everything that is relevant to the game is brought in through this single mechanic. The other thing that I notice that the designer calls out here, which isn't very commonly done, is that they say for each individual result, they say who has what they call first say. So when you achieve your goal, when you put a 4-6 in the goal, then the GM has first say as to how you achieve your goal and what's the consequences of it. But when you put in a 1-3, and you fail to achieve your goal, it's the player who has the first say. And that inverts the typical thing where normally if the player rolls success, it's the player who narrates how they've achieved that particular thing, whereas if they fail, then it might be the GM who says, oh, this is what went horribly wrong. So it's all about, we've empowered the players in giving them the choice to put these things at risk in the first place, and when they do choose to have things fail, which they inevitably will do or take harm, they are the people who are allowed to interpret. It's all very supportive and very safe, and when you feel safe and empowered and supported within a game, it leads you to be more adventurous. It leads you, the only reason people are comfortable doing such crazy things in Apocalypse World and Monster Hearts is because they know the MC has that principle of like to be a fan of the PCs, is that there are not people out there gunning for you if you fail.
There's a fascinating consequence of this mechanic as well, because essentially the people who can narrate facts about the outcome are potentially the person who's playing the character, potentially the GM, or potentially all the other players. What I've found fascinating in some of my more interesting games of Psyrun is that the other players have conceived of a viewpoint of the character I'm playing And when they had the opportunity to create some truth in the narrative about what was going on, they then made that perceived identity the truth. And so I was kind of thinking of the character as one particular set of things. The other players said, no, this is how your character is. Your character is the boss or the leader. The usual things that we talk about loving in games, about permissioning things, so it's like, right, so you see me as the boss. So now I can be a bit bossy, or I can be a bit inspirational. But maybe I saw the character initially as just like someone who was afraid of getting hurt and was distant, and other people saw the distance as being the qualities of a leader. It forces some of that amnesia quality, in that not everything you remember or you conceive of your character is true.
And there's a similarity there with A Penny for My Thoughts, which is the game that we talked about first, which then led us on to Cyrun. You don't have complete control over the memories that you recover, or the progress of the memories that you recover.
And here's a couple of things that I find interesting in the comparison to the Penny with My Thoughts experience. First of all, the player gets to find the questions about their character. So there's a greater variety in tone, like, what's the meaning of this tattoo on my arm? Provides a visual cue during the initial setup, and then is wide open, be it memory of something, it could be something that was inflicted on you. It just feels like the world is much more open and lively.
It sounds like we're in basic agreement that this, the core mechanic with the additional help of the setup is clearly effective in what it's trying to accomplish.
There are two core mechanics. I think they're both really effective. There is the very simple kind of almost like board game escape situation, and there is the dice mechanic, which has its major consequence, the concept of memories and the discovery of personality.
So my next question would be, kind of, are they coherent? Does everything be hold together, or are there things in there that actually don't work quite right? And the two things I wanna put to you is, the first one is the chasers.
Right.
So before I get into this one, great naming. The runners and the chasers. You could name these things anything you like, but what the designer does is say, well, these people are gonna run, so I'm calling you the runners. So the mere fact that you say, oh, I'm a runner, tells you what your role is during the game. Equally, what are you running from? Well, you've got another entity out there called the chasers, and they're chasing you. And beyond that, you don't really need to define much more, apart from that, I'm running, they're chasing. So, but the chasers themselves, it is quite easy to game the chasers so that you quickly move through scenes without doing any significant action and putting an insurmountable lead in front of you, the chasers, so that you never need to worry about them catching up with you. And so I think, I'm not sure, but I think there is a bit of a fudge in the rules here, where there is an example of play in which the GM arbitrarily moved the chasers forwards in order that they once again pose a threat. Because I think this is part of the GM's principles within the game, that the chasers should always pose a threat.
I've never used that rule to advance the chasers, because I have always found that at some point the discord between the group, because games follow a quite common pattern. So you have the first scene where people get to know one another, it's kind of quite a cold start. They then realise that they can put some space between themselves and the chasers, because the location mechanic isn't linked to the dice mechanic, as you've described. And then suddenly when they get safe, they go like, well, who are these people? And like, why am I in their presence? And the interests start to diverge. People start to make different decisions with the dice.
Again, the players are complicit in this.
So, yeah.
The players understand that this is no fun if the chasers are a distant memory. It's that they want them nearby in order that they have that impetus to keep on moving forwards. If they are, you know, if they're half a world away, then at that point the game loses a lot of...
I wonder if it, I mean, like I say, I haven't experienced it, but I wonder if it takes on like a contemplative quality where you know that danger is out there, but it's on the periphery of your consciousness.
What about the start?
So I feel that Cyrun's weakest point is it has a very, very cold start. Essentially, a lot lies on the shoulders of the facilitator, who has to come up with a situation where the characters immediately feel a sense of belonging or affinity and a sense of peril, an immediate peril that is not fatal and dangerous, but that is compelling them to move. I don't think that's easy. When I think I'm going to play a game of Cyrun and I'm going to facilitate it rather than just jumping in, I do spend a lot of time thinking about that opening scene and giving it all the right qualities.
And that's something which is addressed within the rules. I mean, this is a design. I spent some time talking about, okay, you need to start it with a bang. These are kind of the things that you're trying to go for. It does get addressed within it, but it is, I mean, I wonder what more...
Essentially, their advice for creating a compelling opening scene. When I think of other games that immediately tie groups together very quickly, and I'm going to credit, I have a lot of issues with Dungeon World, but one of the things that I think is really great is that it had its bonds phase, which is every Powered by the Apocalypse game has relationships that are built between the characters, but I think the questions are very intriguing in Dungeon World.
The obvious way is to have a question which is about another player, is to have one of your questions being about another player. You realise that you have some kind of connection with this other person, but you don't have the answer yet, and you don't know who's going to provide the answer.
It's really common in this game for the group to fragment. It brings the focus down to particular relationships.
We promised to talk about the crossroads earlier in more detail. Now, the crossroads themselves are essentially a list of different epilogues.
Yes, they're essentially thematic tones for how you're going to array your final scene. The statement about your epilogue is, I am no longer running because. And the number of memories that you have recovered on your run essentially gives you first pick from a list of options.
And the options, as you say, are very thematic in that I have stopped running because I've turned and fought, or because I am now in hiding, or because I am lost.
So probably the most iconic is turning the tables. Like, I've discovered something which means that now I am no longer the runner. You know, the central identity that I have embodied during the game, I will now reverse that and I am the chaser. And I feel that's like one of the strongest iconic ones. Some of the other ones fit quite well. You know, like being lost, if you didn't really engage with the recovery of memories, then you are just drifting along, not really on the run, but nowhere else. You're just in a kind of limbo.
Yeah, a lot of them have that sense of, oh, that thing that was predetermined long before I sat down to play that game, oh, it's suddenly perfect for this situation. It's like it was written for me.
Yes. I kind of like something like that to just lighten the load in the first scene as well.
So I want to move on to why people should play this game, or what people will get out of this game. So obviously you get a chase movie, you get an introductory game. Is it really just an introductory game?
First of all, let's not discount that chase mechanism, because it is awesome. I can't think of another game that has that same sense of pursuit and relief at safety. As an introductory game, regardless of the age, it's definitely there. It's definitely easy. It's an easy game to play. The place where it may pinch an experienced story gamer, I think, is whether you have those character moments, because the game doesn't force that. There is the possibility of finding stillness in the chase and finding the contrast between the action of the mechanic of things going wrong and having to run away from them, and the moments of tranquility where you're not under threat and there's no compelling need to do anything, and you can actually discover the other characters who are quite mysterious to you. It's possible that people may want to spend more time on that when other people are more like, no, I want to go on the run and I want things to blow up and I want this to be scanners.
I played it first as a relatively experienced gamer. I felt there was a lot in it. You have the main thing about essentially an extended form of character creation, is that you are creating your character through, instead of through memory retrieval, well, also through memory retrieval, but also through by this kind of high adventure that you're going through. And it is the exploration of that character and the relationships they start building, and then the sudden turnabout they get when they realize the relationships they're building are with the people who they weren't who they originally thought them to be, is relatively fertile ground for an experienced gaming group. But I take your point that it is possible to have players in there who are more focused on the external obstacles rather than the interpersonal dynamics, and especially with larger groups of people. I mean, it talks about for being up to 5 players, which I'm assuming includes the GM as well, but I've run it with 7 players, with me as GM plus 7 players, which is the largest group I've ever had. And it was manageable, even when they were all, as they often were, all in the scene at the same time. I would say for people about why play this game is this concept of the emergent situation. So, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in when we talk about this kind of legacy, but the idea that you talked about as the GM about putting a lot of thought into that initial situation. But beyond that, I'm betting that actually you put no thought into anything beyond that. Your prep is putting together that initial situation, and then everything beyond that is reactive to what the players are giving you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you spend a lot of thought on the catalyst, but then having set things in motion, it's about providing the platform by which the characters can express their character.
I mean, we talked in the Monster Hearts episode about how the Powered by the Apocalypse games almost kind of created their own style of role-playing with the MC, with the feral GM, where it is the GM who is supportive and who isn't planning ahead. But this is even further than that. And I think this is one where you have an almost entirely reactive GM, where it is in fact far better for them to be reactive than proactive. It is far better for them to listen to, in my experience with it, when I've tried to be a GM trying to manage the story, trying to put interesting things in the paths of the players, trying to lead them to a place where I know the story kind of feels to be naturally going. It has been awkward. It's been difficult. Whereas where I have maybe had a particular image in my mind, but then have been perfectly willing to rewrite it based upon what they are bringing in, but what they reference, is that I had a game, it started off and I thought we would be crossing the US-Mexican border in some kind of people trafficking. Or as soon as the players mentioned somewhere in England, we then had to be in England. And as soon as someone mentioned that they were all went to the same school, suddenly they were school children. And I rewrote, like, not that I'd written, but I changed my perception of what the story was, and was essentially led by the players. This is not a GM-led game, it is a player-led game, where the GM is being led by what the players are introducing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's therefore kind of it's a subtle challenge for the GM to let go of narrative and say, okay, yeah, so we're going to a Greasy Spoon Cafe in East London, so what the interesting characters they might meet here that contrast with what they've said about themselves so far.
So what should designers take from this game?
There are games that kind of use the physical space of the table to describe a geography.
Typically the map-making games, but also Microscope as well.
Yeah, you know, and also from board games, tile-laying games and things like that. But the chasing does seem to be unique. And there's several RPGs that have specialised chase mechanism with tile laying. I mean, like, I was kind of, there's a supplement to the Indiana Jones role-playing game from the 80s, and I was looking through it, and I think it does have this abstract table system for chases, and several of those pulp games have kind of taken various systems of that. But none of them seem as exciting. They've added much more detail and much more richness to the rules. But this simple thing about when you act, things come closer, when things end, they move further away. Really simple rule for a more powerful effect.
I mean, what I love about this and what I think designers can take away from it is that at the end of the game, you are left with a record of your game. It's not a complete record of your game, but fundamentally, you can go saying, hey, this is the crash, this is where we started, and look at all the locations that we went through.
Yeah, the chase has a natural through line. Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you said. We started here and we finished here.
Yeah. We haven't been consciously building it all this time, but actually that is the spine of the story that we've created.
Yeah. Everything that was said about the central mechanic, about letting players choose what is important to them, about sharing the creation between all the participants, I think it's a really useful benchmark. You don't have to use exactly the same mechanic, but I think designers, when they kind of look at what they have created, say, who am I empowering in this mechanic? Because Siren proves that it's possible to engage everyone around the table while really empowering the player who is representing the character to push the story forward.
I mean, what I love about it is, to say, is the idea of this, the placemat representing all the things that are most important in this particular world. So you have that option of whatever you're doing to bring in, to put at risk these things that are, the game has told you, are the most important things. And this mechanic, which, you know, I want to call like the Siren placemat, but I suppose it should be more appropriately called like the other kind dice mechanic. I am just entranced by what if it was this mechanic that had caught on. What if all those Powered by the Apocalypse games out there were using this mechanic instead of the 2d6 roll on a move?
I think what's really interesting is I would draw a comparison to what we were talking about, Microscope being a game without peers. I mean, both of these games are games that have gone through intensive playtesting and land as very complete, excellent play experiences. And I think it's the aspiration of Punk, which is always inspiring, that is that it's rough and you see how it's made and you can see how you could make it better yourself immediately. And I think Siren is just so well judged and balanced that you go like, oh my god, I really have to understand my situation and what kind of game I want to play to kind of replicate that something is so good.
It's so obvious to me about how it could be used in different situations, but yet...
Design those games!
And yet it hasn't, and yet it hasn't been. But I want to design a placemat to use for all the different Powered by the Apocalypse games, which essentially was laid down very clearly. These are the most important things within the game. These are the things that you can place at risk. You know, with Monster Hearts, you know, you put on one of them saying, like, one of your categories is, like, your darker self. So you put a one in there that says you may turn into your darker self. Another one is social pressure. So you may, you know, lose popularity at school if you put a one in there. Like, another one is, like, outside pressures, like, familial pressures. Like, another one is your ability to touch other people's hearts or your relationships with other people. You make a clear statement about your game, about what are the categories that are available for people can place at risk. So there is one other thing that I think designers should take from this game, and this is where I reclaim my Angriest Man in Indie Gaming award that I won a couple of years ago, and that is put more effort into your cover. And I mean no disrespect to anybody involved in the creation of this tremendous game, but when you are going to a convention, right, when you are putting together a sign-up sheet and trying to sell a game to people who maybe have a lot of other choices, you want to find an image to put on there. And the most natural image that you might do is to put on the cover. And when the cover looks this unappealing, it is really, really hard to then get people engaged. This is really a rant against Always Never Now, which had an even worse cover, at least of the ones that I could find. But fundamentally, your cover is your selling point. It's what people who love your game are going to use to try to sell it to other people. Give us a break. Give us a cover that we can sell. So, should Siren be part of our joint canon?
So, I'm going to make the case to say that it should be part of our canon. It should be the second entry into that holy of holies.
The floor is yours.
What is outstanding about this game? So, it's a game with a purpose to create an introduction where the mechanic would be quick to learn, but would have subtlety, that it's not repetitive, that in the course of the play you would learn how to use the mechanism better. It has a very small set of mechanics, and it has two powerful mechanisms that interlock with one another, and there is nothing that is spare in this game. Everything is here because it matters, and that is beautiful from a design point of view. So it achieves its objective, it does so with a powerful design, and it's just very compelling gameplay. It's good fun.
And I will be making the case that it deserves to be in our joint canon, and I concur with my honourable fellow.
Siren is a game about people on the run being persecuted for reasons they don't fully understand and are maybe unjustified. So it might be interesting to compare that with a game where people are on the run for crimes that they have most definitely committed. So I think we should talk about Carolina Deathcrawl, which is a card-driven story game by Jason Morningstar, which is based in the history of his home state of North Carolina and has an interesting staking mechanism and also kind of similar chase and dropout resolution.
My suggestion would be Hell for Leather. One character has been murdered, the other players play the murderers, but the devil has given the wronged man one night to bring vengeance on those who had you slain. It's a card-driven story game based off a tarot deck.